This is an ABC podcast.
Why do arguments so often turn ugly? And can we learn to disagree better? In these polarised times, disagreement is everywhere. But debates around politics or contentious issues can often become shrill, even abusive. It's happened to most of you, I'm sure. A disagreement has gotten out of hand, passions have been inflamed, and the dispute has become personal. Maybe you've been sucked into a toxic Twitter spat that's produced little more than offensive name-calling. So what does the art of debating teach us about how to argue in a more civilised manner? I'm Paul Barclay, and in this Big Ideas, I'm talking to Bo So, author of Good Arguments. Bo's a two-time world debating champion and former debating coach of the Australian national team and the Harvard College Debating Union. Bo spoke to me at Reading's bookstore in Melbourne, and you'll hear a little background noise from the store during this conversation. So the interesting thing about this book, Bo, is that you've written a book about agreeing and disagreeing and arguing, but when you were younger, you went out of your way to avoid conflict and argument, didn't you? Tell us about that.
I'm compensating for something. So what am I overcompensating for? I moved to Australia when I was 8 and I didn't speak English at the time. And I found that the hardest part of doing that, of crossing language lines, was adjusting to real-life conversation. And the hardest conversations to adjust to were arguments. That was where my standing apart from my peers felt most threatening. And I resolved at that time to be a very agreeable person, to smile and to nod and keep most of my thoughts to myself. And the thing that changed that was I joined the debating team. And I did that off the strength of a promise that my year five teacher made me, which was that in debating, when one person speaks, no one else does. And to someone who had been spoken over and interrupted and spun out of conversation, that sounded like a kind of salvation. And once I was there, I found a structure, a set of skills, a community that gave me a chance to be heard. And in some ways, I've been with it ever since.
You believe, I think, that feeling marginal, as you did when you were a migrant newly arrived in Australia, in the end was one of your great strengths. Tell us about that and how, for example, it helped you to read a room.
Yeah. For me, there were obviously biographical elements to that, feeling marginal culturally, linguistically. But I think actually everybody is at their best in an argument when they're feeling a little bit on the periphery, as we all do in different spaces and at different times. And I think the reason for that is we learn to read a room before we start speaking, right? We often, as a matter of self-preservation, consider where the other side is coming from. And we have a kind of a humility that comes with considering maybe my perspective isn't going to carry the day. But that the best that we can do perhaps is to work, right? To be candid and to try and be as persuasive as we can. So I think it is kind of a feature of the debating world that oddly the people who do well, I think they're all kind of slightly marginal characters actually, but the people who do well tend to have that element of history, but I don't think it's just a biographical thing. I think it is a kind of a disposition that we step in and out of.
But from a biographical perspective, you think that learning to debate became a source of empowerment for you?
The idea that your differences with others can be the basis for something other than exclusion or pain or separation, And embracing that possibility, empowering is one way to describe it. Another way is it allowed me to engage with the fullness of life in a way that I hadn't before.
Yeah. So I think most of us in the room know what bad disagreement looks like in its various forms. What, Bo, does healthy disagreement look like, and how important is listening to the other person in that?
It's crucial. Because there's lots of different descriptions for what a bad disagreement is, but one is the two sides never connect, actually. And we can fail, even sitting across from one another, to miss each other, right? And we can do that because instead of seeing you in your fullness, I see a conservative or a liberal, right? We can do that because I see you as someone who hasn't yet grasped the truth that I somehow have. And so for me, in debating, listening is a very demanding activity, right? And part of it is when you're listening to an opponent, you're very faithfully transcribing what the other team has said. And the reason why that's important for me is because it helps see what is already true, that there is someone across the table from you who, in the fullness of who they are, is different from you. And so there's lots of features of good argument and bad argument, but the one that comes to mind, particularly through that framing of the question, is one in which you never connect.
Mm. Yeah, and that's common in bad disagreement. In debate, though, there are certain rules, certain principles. You, as you say, you speak without interruption. Everybody is given equal time. You take turns in making your arguments and rebutting arguments. And as you mentioned, you're almost expected to listen respectfully. Many of those preconditions do not exist in real life disagreement, do they? How do we get a bit more of the spirit of those debating concepts into real life disagreement?
I think there's two ways. One is, I don't think we should shy away from structure, right? And these are not overly onerous structural elements. To say, don't interrupt, or we're going to take turns. I get a go, you're going to get a go, but then I'm going to be able to come back to it. I think being more deliberate in the way we communicate about our differences or in disagreements feels to me a worthwhile thing. I mean, we do yoga, right? And we do meditation. And I don't think the structural elements of imposing some order on talking, on having the conversations that tend to be the most explosive, divisive, I don't think that's too much to ask for in some ways.
Mm.
But I think the second is, in addition to the structure, there is a kind of a underlying set of skills and a kind of a quality of judgment that you develop through the course of many conversations, through learning about what an argument actually is, what responding to it might look like, that allows people to, I think, come in with more equipment and a broader set of tools to be able to approach these conversations.
I mean, the world we live in is full of conflict everywhere we look, on the internet and social media, our public figures. Can you understand? I mean, and you've given your specific context why you were conflict averse when you first arrived in Australia and were finding your way before you found debating. Can you understand why people avoid disagreement? Because to them it equals conflict and they simply don't want more conflict in their lives.
I can. And I used to think that conflict aversion was a kind of a vote of no confidence in your own abilities and a kind of a lack of self-confidence. But nowadays, I think it's just as much a lack of confidence in the other person, right? In the person across the table from you, in their ability to receive you with some grace, right? And sometimes that lack of faith is justified in a world where we've allowed the skills of disagreeing to deteriorate so much, right? Other times, that lack of faith can be self-reinforcing, because when we go into a disagreement expecting it to go badly, we often go in with our arms folded and we're defensive and we're quick to anger. And if you have that set of conditions, it's hard to imagine how a disagreement might go well. So I do understand where that lack of confidence might come from. And my hope is that one response to it is by restoring not only a skill set, but a shared skill set that you can count on to be able to engage in conversation with more people about a wider variety of things.
I'll come to some of those skills in a moment, but does disagreeing well require us to remove emotion and passion from our argument and be entirely rational? Whatever rational means?
I hope not. Both because the emotions are often signals of great truths about our lives. It's a tool that we have that adds spice and life to how we speak to one another. But I think maybe one thing that debating does is, and one of the things that you learn in debate, is it's not kind of do or die, right? In debating, you are going to lose. And sometimes you're going to lose despite being right, right?
And what do you mean by that, losing but being right?
So the World Championships for debate, for example, has 500 teams, right? And there's one winner. So almost everybody is in the 499. And the experience that you have there is you realize you can be on the right side of the topic from your perspective. You're really firmly convinced this is the right thing, but you were just less persuasive on the day, right? That you failed to sell the bag of goods that you had. And that separation, I think, helps cool some of the emotional elements because it makes disagreeing well a matter of kind of skill and of practice rather than of simply glimpsing the truth.
So you break down the structure of an argument in your book. You talk about the four W's. What is the point you are making? Why is this point true? When has this happened before? And who cares, or why does it matter? Can you just take us through that? And maybe you've got some examples that you can use to explain how an argument is deconstructed, the anatomy, if you like, of an argument.
Yeah, and the first mental jump that I'm hoping to encourage people to take is just to recognize that an argument is not just anything kind of said in expression of your views, right? It's not a kind of all your thoughts on a given subject. It has a particular kind of structure. And the starting place for me is to say an argument at its minimum has to do two things. It has to show that the claim that it's making is true and that it's important. So if you're arguing that we should get this model of car because it's the most fashionable one, you have to show that it is in fact the most fashionable one and that it being the most fashionable one means that you should get it, right? As opposed to thinking about cost or the other things we might think about. So the structure that I came up with in the book for trying to remind people to meet those two basic burdens is to say, what's the argument that you're making? Why is it true? When has it happened before? What's an example or some evidence or some case study that can explain how it might unfold in real life? And why does it matter? Why should people care about that? And I hope it's a kind of a versatile enough thing that people can, in the middle of a conversation, think, have I proven this element of the argument.
So we can apply those principles to real life debate, you think?
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping so. Whether it be, you know, in the workplace, you're arguing for a particular hire or a proposal that you're making, those seem to me roughly the questions that the listener would want answered. To give another example, let's say you're arguing for vegetarianism, right? And you're saying, we should all be vegetarians because it's good for the environment, right? So the two things that argument would have to do is show that it is, in fact, good for the environment. And the other is, it being good for the environment means we should be vegetarian, as opposed to caring about all the other things that we might care about. So when you're refuting an argument, you would almost take the opposite perspective of either showing that it is, in fact, not very good for the environment, or delinking the truth of that argument from what you wanted to do, which is to convince the other person to be vegetarian.
Mm. Now, the key part of arguing is persuading. Now, this is more than just marshalling facts. This is how, I suppose, you marshal those facts. You, I think, say if argumentation is what we say, rhetoric is how we say it. Rhetoric, of course, is a key part of persuasiveness. I mean, I've been persuaded in the past to change my mind about a viewpoint that I've had. I was actually trying to think of an example of that before I came, and I can't, but I know I have been. Talk about the importance of rhetoric and how it assists with debate and discussion.
And this may be one channel through which the emotions come back.
Yep.
Right? So rhetoric is easily talked down.
Pejorative.
Pejorative.
Mm.
When we say rhetoric, we mean something like mere rhetoric, right? It's just kind of empty words. And I want to say there is no finer equipment than we have than the language that we use, than the inflections of voice that we have. And I go through in the book various techniques that I think the debate community has come up with and principles that it has come up with to use that equipment to good effect. But I think the part that I would want to emphasize now is that when you're taking great care in thinking about not only what it is that you believe, right, which is the what you think, but how you say it, that is often the opening through which you're taking the listener into account, right? So I have all these ideas here, and it's a bit of a puzzle how I make that comprehensible to the listener, how I make that legible to the listener. And I think rhetoric at its best has that.
Mm.
And that the even the soaring quality of rhetoric is, I don't think, a kind of a magic, but it is a, it comes from the connection.
So why did things become so bad? How did disagreement become so toxic, hyper-partisan, polarised, divisive, whatever you'd like to describe it as? Certainly we've reached those heights at the moment. You see it reflected in politics as one example, and you particularly see it reflected in social media discourse. Is social media to blame for the type of bad disagreement that we see so commonly today?
I think it's certainly a part of it. Mm. And the reason it's a part of it is because the channels through which we speak, they matter, right? They bear on the conversation that we're having. The acoustics of this room changes the nature of the conversation we're having. So what are the values that we're importing from social media, perhaps into the disagreements that we have every day? I think often in social media, there's an indifference to the person who's sitting across the table from you. Right, you're ostensibly arguing with someone on Twitter, but actually you're kind of doing it for the applause of the people on the wings who already agree with you.
Mm.
So you're talking past the person. And I see that often actually in everyday life of, it's not your view that I'm interested in, but some idea of you, some identification that you might have that I take issue with. That indifference to one another, I think, is something that we import from social media. Another one might be, you know, I started the conversation today with the hashtagables and all that. There is a way in which social media makes us more machine-like in our arguments, more categorizable in the way in which we express ourselves, right? And that's what we're doing when we're hashtagging. We're making it easier for the algorithms to catch what we're saying. And I see that sometimes in everyday conversation too. There's a kind of a meme. And part of the argument that I want to make in this book is a return to particular encounters and particular conversations rather than something that's typical of a type.
I think social media disagreement is highly performative and hyperbolic.
Yeah.
There are two aspects of it. But I think also I've been thinking about arguments, disagreements I've seen. There seems to be a lot at stake for people in an argument.
Yes.
Often people are not so much arguing about, say, whether gun ownership should be a right or whether women should be allowed to choose to terminate their pregnancy.
I
mean, they're both debates in themselves with arguments for and against, but what they're arguing about and what they're asserting is a sense of their own identity.
Yes.
They can't separate their identity from the argument. I mean, how do we deal with this where disagreement is so intrinsically personal?
I see two things there, Paul. One is individual conversations become proxies for bigger wars, right? And part of, I think, what I'm arguing for in the book is one conversation at a time.
Yeah.
It's not a proxy war for, you know, prosecuting the merits of liberalism all the time, right? We're just talking about this one issue.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing, is just defining the boundaries of the conversation to say, you know, we can have those searching conversations, but let's do it one issue at a time. On the question about ego, it's just what a heavy burden it is. And I think social media amplifies this, but this is a feature of our age too, that we are all kind of brands. And as a result, you feel like all your views have to chime with the brand. What was once the province of kind of PR professionals has become the water that everybody drinks. And one of the things that you do in debating is sometimes you have to argue a position you don't believe. Not forever, just for 2 hours, and then you revert. But that is an arena or a place of where you can play. You can try on different positions for size. And you emerge from the 2 hours slightly changed, right? And it's a kind of a play that I think children take very easily too. And debating starts at a really young age. And the question for me is, how do we play like that as adults? And I think having a space where it's not that we completely set aside the ego, but where that's not quite so foregrounded in the way in which we have our conversation, I think can be useful.
I mean, that is, in a nutshell, the essential difference between competitive debating and real-life disagreement.
Yeah.
That you will, from time to time, perhaps 50% of the time,
yes,
be assigned to argue a view that you do not personally believe
yes
in. I'm curious, because you're a technician when it comes to structuring a debate, do you ever convince yourself of a position that you once opposed through structuring an argument in a competitive debate? Can you think of an example, perhaps, where your own opinion has changed as a result of this, or has moved, maybe?
I think it happens often. Just one thing that comes to mind is another way of describing this dynamic is that debate is a kind of a game. And I don't think that's something to shy away from, right? Games change us. And this is a country where athletes are public intellectuals. not making a comment about that, but it does make room for games and the and the value that it has. And so the place where I would come at this is there is the experience of arguing for a position you don't believe, but even when you are assigned a position that chimes with what you think, one of the things debaters do is in the last little bit before they go on, they flick to a new page and they try and brainstorm the best arguments for the opposing perspective. Or they go over their materials through the eyes of the opposition to try and poke as many holes as they can. And on almost any issue that I've debated, I think that exercise has not always kind of been a road to Damascus moment where I've done a 180 degree flip on my position, but it's almost always left me with the view that my perspective on this is not complete. And that gray area, I think, is useful, especially at a time when I feel, you know, different sides in these long-standing arguments feel kind of stuck where they are. So that's the way in which I think it moderates most of my views. I'm sure there are instances where I would have changed positions, but that's the more common experience that I have.
In social media, you can choose to bypass conflict mostly by finding your tribe, communicating with your tribe, agreeing ferociously with them and insulating yourself from the ugly forces outside of that comfortable filter bubble that you're in. But you make the point that the ancient Greeks believed that it was our civic responsibility to argue, to help weed out fallacious arguments. I mean, this was essentially what the sophists did when they would travel around and engage in argument. It's quite utopian, isn't it? I mean, I wonder too, is your book a utopian core, that we can build a better society through better disagreement?
It's aspirational. but it is worth thinking about what the shape of a utopia might be. And the Greeks feel quite distant. I was recording the audiobook and I didn't know how to say the words. So I had to do, you know, Wiktionary kind of thing. But so maybe a more recent kind of historical moment is debate is obviously a huge part of the parliamentary tradition, right, that we carry forth in Australia. And the format of debate that I did is called parliamentary debate. And you might think it comes out of the parliament, comes out of the House of Commons. And there's ideas of, you know, Her Majesty's loyal opposition, for example, right? An expression of loyalty through dissent and disagreement. But in fact, the debate format comes not from the parliament, but what was happening next door at the pubs and clubs and coffee houses, where people would take the structure of parliament and mimic it and debate the things that affect them every day. So there is something utopian about it, but the shape of the utopia or the location of the utopia is not for me like the Agora, although it's great to go there. It might actually be in pubs and coffee houses, the kinds of disagreements that we have every day. And for me, you know, going back to the biographical point of where I found my voice, where I felt like I came into my own as a person, The architecture of physical spaces matters, but so does the structure that we create when we're in conversation.
Mm.
And so utopia for me is not in some storied place. It is in places of public gathering.
Mm.
And it's what we build when we're in conversation with another person.
You write about deplatforming, and you quote Barack Obama, who said, anybody who comes to speak to you and you disagree with, you should have an argument with them. You shouldn't silence them by saying, you can't come and say this because I'm too sensitive to hear what you say. You go on to say that you're not sold on this notion of civic silence or civil silence yourself, but then say that the adversarial format of debate may well be inappropriate for some sensitive topics. Can you talk a bit about that, how we deal with public debates around highly controversial issues with possibly bad faith protagonists? Is there an argument sometimes for silence and yep. deplatforming?
It's a very difficult question, and it's probably the one that I wrestle with most, and I've had to wrestle with most as I've toured this book. And the reason why it's difficult is because I really do believe disagreement can be revelatory and inclusive, that it can be generative, progressive, but it is a burden to argue. And it's not a burden borne equally. So what I say in the book is, you know, the one bright line that I draw is I don't think we should debate the equal moral worth of persons. So debating whether one race or gender or group of people is inferior to another feels to me quite, in addition to everything else, quite antithetical to what debate is, which is we give people an equal opportunity to be heard because we recognize their equal moral worth. So that's where I think silence is justified. Mm. Right? And there are other considerations, like if you're a media organization, what are the optics of saying there are two sides of this argument, for example? And there may be more specific judgments, but that seems to me the baseline. And on the kind of the broader deplatforming and this set of conversations, I think it can be a kind of a cruelty to insist that people debate and disagree about their ideas when the conditions aren't there for that conversation to be productive, to be safe. And so for me, the shadow of the right to debate is the responsibility to do it well. And sometimes it's that shadow that we have to be attentive to.
Another barrier to good disagreement with someone is, how can you have a good disagreement when both sides can't even agree on some basic, objectively verifiable facts? Like, how can you have an argument with somebody about the best way for government to deal with the COVID pandemic or the best way to mitigate climate change if those people do not accept the science around climate change or COVID?
It's very difficult. And debate is one of the most powerful engines that I think we have for discovering truth, right? And the reason is the great advantage of truth over lies is things tend to add up, right? And so disagreeing about it should be a way to allow truth to surface. But we're living at a time where misinformation and mistruths don't stand on their own. They're becoming constitutive of entire worldviews.
Mm.
And when that happens, there isn't this point of contact.
Mm.
So I'm pretty sure that misinformation, disinformation thrives in information silos,
mm.
right? In communities based around agreement that egg themselves onto more and more extreme views.
Mm.
So I'm pretty sure about that. But how we have conversations where that worldview has set in. I think that might be a slice where debate alone won't be enough. Mm. That there is a broader kind of education that has to happen.
Bo, you were a journalist for a while. You got to cover an election campaign. You got to see for a period of time anyway how the media worked up close. What did you learn from that experience and from how the media can or does or doesn't contribute to good and healthy debate?
It's a wonderful question. I think the moments where the media does poorly on this score is when it mistakes its role. And for me, its role is to serve the public, but specifically to serve the public conversation by providing information that doesn't substitute for the kind of deliberation that citizens engage in, right? So one of the more troubling things that I saw in the media sometimes is, you know, when you're watching talking heads and pundits argue, for example, they're almost like gladiators to whom we've outsourced the responsibility of talking with our political opponents. So they become like avatars, you know?
Proxies for our own opinions
proxies,
sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
we all have our favourite avatar that we get behind.
Exactly. And that's in addition to all the problems that it gives rise to, it does seem like a kind of an abdication that the media sometimes encourages to become the story, to drive the story, as opposed to serve the conversations that should ideally be happening outside the pages of a newspaper, outside the airwaves.
Mm. My son works in the IT sector and he's always posing this question about an idea. How does it scale?
Yeah.
How does this idea scale? After finishing the manuscript of your book, you sent it out to some people to get some feedback and one person responded with the question, how does debate scale?
Yeah.
In other words, can your ideas for individuals having better arguments scale and improve society? What was your response to that, to that question?
I mean, cable television scales, right? It scales because you can have two people having a conversation and an infinite number of people watching it, retweeting it, and so on. And my book and my friend who works in venture capital told me this makes a terrible pitch deck, my book, because the argument, and I sort of thought about how do we institutionalize this, right? And I think an honest answer to your earlier question about how did we get in this mess is there are institutional factors, right? So inequality and stratification, all of those things bear on how we talk to one another. And I don't want to minimize the importance of responding to those. But I want to say that the things that we do every day, right? What we say to one another, how we say it, those things are the province of democracy too, right? Those conversations make up the health of the society in which we're living too. And that doesn't scale. That really is me and you. But if you have that, and think about how many conversations you have every day, it doesn't scale in that traditional sense, but it is one way in which our influence in the world can be quite outsized.
I suppose it is a bit like, as you said before, taking one argument at a time.
Yeah.
Improving one set of discourse at a time.
Yeah, I think there's just no hacks.
Yeah.
Right? I think there's no hacks.
So just a final question. You're about to begin second year law, I understand, and law, much like debating, requires you to advocate to the best of your ability on behalf of the client you represent, regardless of your personal views. The adversarial model of determining guilt and innocence assumes that regulated conflict is the best way for us to reach the best outcome. Perhaps not quite the truth, but something close to it. This is the world that at some point in the next few years that you'll be moving into. Do you believe that this is indeed the adversarial model, the best way to resolve our disputes, our criminal and civil disputes?
Well, I don't know. I am quite sure, or I think, that there are many virtues of the adversarial system, right? In kind of the way in which you framed it, it requires people to be the best of themselves in some ways, to present the best case for the side they've been given. The part where I'm not sure is how much space that adversarial system should occupy among all the other ways in which we could deal with our differences. And this is something I wrestle with the book as well, is debate is one answer to the question, how do we disagree better? It's not the only answer to the question. In the way that disagreeing better is one answer to the question, how do we deal with the fact that we're different but we must coexist? There are other ways of sorting through our differences. It might be negotiation, right? It might be collaboration. It might just be listening. And so I'm unsure where the boundaries of the adversarial system in the legal sense should be, right? Whether there should be more room for forgiveness, for example, or grace or mercy. These are not concepts that come easily to the law. And so it's that broader question of how do we coexist with our differences that interests me. And one thing that I want to keep thinking about is how bounded the answers are and what the other answers are should be to that question.
I'm in conversation with former debating coach and world debating champion Beau So about his book, Good Arguments. We'll finish off with a couple of audience questions, which I'll paraphrase because they were off mic. The first question was about Beau's skills as a debater and how they translated into writing his book.
In debating, you actually don't use the first person very much. It's just a kind of a, here's the truth. And you know, sort of hail it down from somewhere. And in an early version of this book, it was a kind of an impersonal third person, I know all this stuff, here's the truth. And there are many writers who do that well, but I found it actually very hard to write across that distance of, I feel like I know some stuff, most people are coming to this cold. And I just lack the skills to bridge that. And so the jump that I had to make is think, who else didn't know a whole lot about debating? It's me, when I was younger. And bringing in the biography and trying to write down how my thoughts changed on this subject over time, I thought would allow me to better guide the reader, but also to be more honest about where I was coming from, to acknowledge the ambivalence in my position, right? The things that I'm not sure about, how my thinking about those things changed over time. That was my main experience writing the book. And in some ways, it called on a different set of skills at times than what I'd learned in debate.
Another member of the audience noticed Beau frequently paused for long periods before and during his answers to my questions, carefully considering his responses. We've incidentally cut back the length of these long silences. If a politician or public figure took as long to respond to a question, the audience member suggested, this would likely be seen as an admission they were not across the detail of a certain subject. Long silences are not a luxury afforded to us in everyday arguments.
It's a really wonderful question. I write a bit in the book about there's this phenomenon called spreading in some formats of debate where people talk at a pace that's slightly faster than an auctioneer, if you've ever heard that. And the basic arithmetic that gets you there is pretty simple, is more arguments, more points. And so you go as fast as humanly possible. And I write about that as a kind of a style of argument that's designed to overwhelm rather than bring the person with you. So how do we deal with that? I think the first is there is a kind of a power in being able to defer a conversation, right? And I don't think it's something that we're allowed to do often, but I think a society that makes more room for people saying, I'm not sure about that, or I'm going to come back to that. Or maybe one thing that comes to mind is we can have a different kind of conversation in the meantime, right? So even if you and I disagree about something, if I'm not sure about my position, one way in which we should speak to one another is I should just ask you a lot of questions until I do have a kind of an idea, right? So there may be a time for deferring disagreement and finding a different mode of conversation that works a little bit better. And the more modes of conversation we're able to engage in, I think may be better for that. And I think maybe more practically in debating, there's also a lot of just preparation that I think is always kind of worrying on in the background, right? Of being up to speed on the things that you're expected to think about, of putting forward your ideas in a clear way. And I think that's a part of it too. But I do think it's a kind of a worrying thing that we code silence and ambivalence in that way. Although I have to say, it's a script that we're all following. But when you deviate from it, I think people are pretty understanding, actually. And that there is more room for that than I think we sometimes expect.
That was Bo So, a former world debating champion and debating coach of the Australian national team and the Harvard College Debating Union. He was speaking to me at Reading's bookstore. Bo's book is called Good Arguments. More information about Bo and his books can be found at the Big Ideas homepage. Arguing and debating depend on listening to what the other person is saying, but we're not very good at it. How can we become better listeners? Here's Kate Murphy, author of You're Not Listening, speaking with Michaela Kalowski.
We're conditioned to think of listening as something that's submissive. And then, you know, further on in school, there's debate, there's elocution, there's study in communications, but never really a study or course of study that has to do with listening. And so we're really conditioned to think that speaking is more important. And, you know, as a result, we really don't know what listening is. The thing I found fascinating in all the interviews, hundreds of interviews I've done, is I would ask everyone, what does it mean to be a good listener? And I would get this deer in the headlights look. People wouldn't be able to tell me. Now, at the same time, they'd be able to tell me very clearly and very quickly what it meant to be a bad listener. Things like looking at your phone, interrupting, responding in an illogical way. And it really goes to show that we have more experience not being listened to than being really heard. And so that really is what started me on this path to write this book. What does it mean to be a good listener? How does it feel to be listened to? And to give people practical advice about how to enjoy both in their life.
There's a very poignant part early in the book where you ask a lot of the people you're interviewing who listens to you. And the answers were very telling, that most people weren't listened to by their loved ones or their closest friends. They were listened to by therapists. They were often listened to by people they paid. So hairdressers, therapists, counselors of different kinds, or strangers. And I thought that was very telling. I'm going to try and today with you to pull apart all the different aspects of listening and talking and thinking and cognition and speech. There's so much interesting stuff here. But I wondered as well if we can talk about why do people love to talk more than they love to listen? What does that say about who we are as humans or what we are as humans?
Part of it is just what we've been conditioned to do. We've sort of been told that it's all about shaping the narrative, staying on message. Value is placed on what you project and not what you absorb. And really, as you said earlier, listening is really the more powerful position in communication. And so, you know, I really think part of it is just what we've been conditioned, but also, you know, we want people to like us. And so there's this urgency to, you know, let me tell you why I'm valuable. And really, to really connect with another person, it works the other way. You have to really listen to the other person to know what's valuable to them. And really, that's really probably the most generous thing you can do to another person is to really listen to them. And by that, by virtue of listening, you know their level of understanding, you know the maybe tender points that maybe you should stay away from. And you're also able to repeat back things they said with a little humorous twist on them, so which makes you even more connected to the other person. So we really got it backwards in how to connect with another person.
You mentioned a lot of really interesting philosophers and writers and social scientists throughout the book. And one of them you mentioned is Carl Rogers, who I think coined the phrase active listening. So we're all clear at the beginning of this conversation where we need to be listening. Can you describe what he explained active listening to be?
Well, that term active listening has gotten a bit distorted because it's been co-opted by corporate culture. It's even in employee handbooks now. And what they say active listening is very different than what Carl Rogers said active listening is. And his idea of listening is to really use all your senses and to really think about the feelings and emotions that are beneath the words. And maybe even trying to help the other person come to grips of what they're really thinking, because they may be having a hard time saying it. So by asking questions and really being an active participant in the conversation to help you listen better. So part of it, it's not just, as I said before, just being quiet. It's not a submissive stance. It's very much an interaction of latching onto something the other person says and asking questions, trying to get to the heart of the matter and really the heart of the other person.
I was surprised by my response to things in the book. One of them was this idea that, you know, if I'm close to someone, if I have a good friend or a spouse, they must be the person who can listen to me the best. But as you brilliantly clarify in the book, that's often not the case, that closeness often gets in the way of our being able to hear people we think we know. What's going on in that process that stops us really hearing people in an attentive way when we know them?
Well, there's actually even a scientific name for it. It's called the closeness communication bias, and it's well documented in the scientific literature. And as you say, while you might think the person that you love the most is the person that you would listen to the most, but in fact, the opposite is true. And really what it comes down to is one, as wonderful as intimacy and connection is or are with another person, it leads to complacency. And so you have this idea of, I already know what you're going to say.
Kate Murphy, author of You're Not Listening, speaking with Michaela Kalowski. There's a link to the entire discussion, one of our more popular programs, on the Big Ideas homepage. That's it for today. I'm Paul Barclay. Until next time, bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.